I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. Today, the privacy paradox. No one likes the idea that Facebook, Google, and who knows who else are mining the data from our phones and laptops and tablets and tracking our every move when we're online. If that's true, then why do we willingly hand over so much personal information about ourselves, our dogs, our kids, what we're having for lunch, and what we're wearing for dinner? Do we really care about online privacy? Plus, there are new laws regarding what information service providers can collect and sell. How are the rules of the road changing? What does it matter, and what will it mean for us collectively and individually? The philosopher Firmin de Brabander, legal expert Melanie Teplinsky, and cybersecurity expert Avi Rubin join me to talk about the new age of online privacy. Midday starts right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're joining us this afternoon. Today, our topic is online privacy. Virtually everything we do and say online can be collected and sold. Later in the show, I'll be joined by two scholars who think a lot about the technical and legal ways in which our privacy is up for grabs and how that might be changing now that we're in the Trump era. But first, a discussion about what we might call the privacy paradox. We say one thing when it comes to online privacy, but many of us act in decidedly unprivate ways when we're on the internet. We often say that we don't want to be spied on by big government or by big data, the companies that collect and sell information about every place we go online. So that's what we say, but our behavior suggests that we don't really care about our privacy as much as we say we do. We post all sorts of intimate details about our lives and our families. It's not unheard of for people to post confessions to crimes online, or in many horrifying instances, the crimes themselves. We voluntarily allow apps to know exactly where we are at all times. That information is valuable to all sorts of companies and sometimes to certain government agencies. So do we perhaps care about privacy in some abstract way, but not enough to behave online in a way that would keep our information more secure? And if we say we value privacy, are we as a society able to articulate what's wrong with losing privacy? Well, my first guest is a professor and philosopher who has thought a great deal about our relationship with online privacy and why privacy matters. Firmin de Brabander is an associate professor of philosophy at MICA here in Baltimore, where he's taught since 2005. He's the author most recently of the book Do Guns Make Us Free? He's working on a book about privacy, and an article that he wrote recently on the subject caught our eye. So Firmin de Brabander is here with me in Studio A. Good to see you, sir.
Thank you.
You are welcome to join our conversation about internet privacy. 410-662-8780 is the number here at Midday. Our email, midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle to follow us at Midday Tom Hall. So, Firmin, you wrote a piece in a journal called Aeon, and you talked about how digital media has so radically transformed our notions of a couple of things, shame and intimacy. What do you mean?
Well, I mean that our online behavior suggests that we are rather shameless. We are revealing details about our lives pretty freely and openly, and it's kind of shocking. And they are these are also sometimes either mundane details or intimate details. And it's just surprising that we are so willing to offer this up, even though we talk the talk of privacy otherwise. At least we feign horror at the kind of revelations that Edward Snowden reveals about what the government is looking into and collecting about us. And a lot of people I've noticed, you know, the private sector is even more aggressive when it comes to collecting data about us. And when I talk with people about those kinds of things, such as, you know, the famous example of where Target knew that its customers were pregnant and then sent coupons, directed coupons to them. When I discuss that with people, they also suggest that they are appalled by this, and yet our behavior otherwise is quite remarkable. One way I put it is that I've said that we are the agents of our own surveillance because we offer it up. We're, you know, the powers that want to know about us, they have, at the end, they have rather little work to do because we're so busy telling everybody about us, where we are, what we're doing, what we think, and our most basic facts of our lives.
The trade-off, though, the upside for all this sharing is convenience in
That's
a lot
right.
of ways. I mean, if you've got news to share, I've got a new job, or, you know, my wife is pregnant, or mm-hmm. our daughter just got accepted into college, you can let everybody know at the flick of a button.
Well, what's so interesting from a philosophical standpoint is that, you know, I saw the ad for the recent, is it the Apple Watch? They are using the word freedom over and over again. This stuff is sold to be empowering and liberating. And yet from a philosophical standpoint, all the philosophers who study this issue, and, you know, at least the most prominent ones who talk to, you know, surveillance and spying, they all point out the same thing, that we are consistently less free as we are surveyed and watched. And yet we are sold the instruments of our surveillance on the promise of freedom and liberation and empowerment. And indeed, with this cell phone, I feel a lot more powerful. I feel a lot more free and independent. I can do so much more.
But
so there's the paradox.
The paradox is there's a line then between surveillance and communication.
I mean, absolutely.
I did an event at the City Lit Project, the City Lit Festival, a couple of weekends ago with this wonderful Nigerian author who lives here in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
She said that the essence of love mm-hmm. is being known. This mm-hmm. is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She said the essence of love is being known.
Yes.
Knowing that someone's paying attention, someone's caring.
Right.
I mean, social media allows us all in our own way, big and small, mm-hmm. to be known.
Absolutely.
It's about love, isn't it?
It is about affirmation. It helps our egos, that's for sure. If I post something and I know it is liked by certain people, that makes me feel, yes, I'm affirmed in my lifestyle and in my choices and what I think. So there is a certain amount of neediness that is on display there, that's for sure. But, you know, in thinking about, you know, how we use our devices to make us freer, you know, the concern is that when we, to the extent that we know we are watched, to the extent that we know we are followed and surveyed by some who knows who's watching, the government or Target, and who knows exactly what they want to know, the worry is that that kind of compulsion will work itself insidiously so that we will all silently and freely conform our lives. That's the angle that I'm interested in.
Freely conform our lives.
What does that mean? I know that sounds, that's another paradoxical statement. But the point is, I'm drawing on the work of Michel Foucault, a French philosopher, who talked a lot about this. He says that surveillance is the optimal form of oppression in a democracy where you know, the citizens think they are free. And the way it works is this. If you are watched by you don't know who, and indeed, when I talk to people, I say, are you aware that in your online dealings and your digital dealings that you're watched, they all admit they are. They have no idea by who or to what extent, but everyone admits, at least rationally, that they are. If you know you're watched, but you're not sure to what end and to what purpose exactly, you're going to modify your behavior, maybe in small ways, to conform to what you think is the ideal, what said power might want. You will live less dangerously. You'll live more safely. And so the concern is in the democracy that our freedom is undermined to that extent. And the kicker is that we do this because we're not sure exactly who is watching us for what end. We make these changes of ourselves. We do this on our own free will. And so,
no one is quote-unquote forcing us to behave differently.
And so the illusion of freedom is there.
We're choosing to behave differently.
Exactly.
Because we know we're being watched.
We're choosing to conform, put it that way. And so the concern for democracy is that, you know, democracy would seem to require independent, free-thinking, and courageous citizens. And this is pointing in the other direction.
So when it comes to shame, mm-hmm. shame, and I guess Foucault is one of the people who talked
about Plato.
This. And Plato himself.
Plato's my principal one I'm thinking of here.
On shame. So shame is a necessary component mm-hmm. of a moral life.
According to Plato, yes.
Because you've got to have certain things that are going to be abhorrent to mm-hmm. you morally in order
right.
to avoid that behavior.
That's right.
So confession, mm-hmm. which so many people do online,
that's right,
is liberating because it unburdens people. You talk about this in your piece.
That's right.
It's the unburdening of shame.
That's right.
So isn't that necessary to do? You can't just walk around with a bunch of shame cooped up inside.
That's right. Well, that's where I'm torn. I do admit that confession is liberating and is intended to be, in its original sacramental form, it is intended to be liberating in a way. Interestingly, though, I am also thinking of the philosopher Foucault in this regard. He argues that confession is rather something also that meets the demands of power. This is what the powers that be want. They want us to be confessing animals, as he puts it. The powers that be want us to feel that we must divulge the truth about ourselves, that truth must be outed, that it cannot stay cooped up and held in. I'm torn at that point. I do feel that there's something liberating about this confession, but I don't know. I'll be honest with you. When I look at the nature of things that my friends on Facebook are divulging, I'm not really sure how liberating it is. To mention that you do an update. I'm at Starbucks right now, or I was so drunk last night. These kinds of things that people, I don't know. I'm evaluating the moral and the political significance and value of these things.
Yeah, when it comes to value, that's a whole other thing.
Oh, yes.
The fact that you're at Starbucks isn't something I necessarily need to know to live my life. If you want to tell me Facebook, you're welcome to, but I could care less.
Does the NSA need to know that? Does it matter to them? Would Target like to know? Probably. What does this do to me as a democratic citizen? I'm also interested in that. Ultimately, my interest as a political philosopher. What does this mean about us as citizens?
Because you write in your piece that there's no better way to divide and subdue a people.
That's right.
And seduce them into self-regulation, what you've just been
talking about,
this conformity.
Right.
No better way to do that than to expose their perversions, but promise absolution. That's a wacky statement for me. I mean, is the NSA promising absolution?
No, but the traditional notion of confession as such is absolution, right? Just by getting it off my chest, I'm absolved, But it's true. We are posting our perversions online. We're sharing them for the world. Well, not all of us, but many are. It's just this curious phenomenon that we see. But the absolution would not come from any benevolent power that is then blessing us afterwards. But this is just simply this imperative that Foucault talks about in Western civilization's desire to get it off our chests. You see, this is something he sees operative in modern science, in Western science, as well as Christianity. This notion that the truth must be outed, it must surge to the top. And we as persons, we must do the same duty with our own soul, and we must out our sins. But of course, this is always happy news for the powers that be. They get to read us like an open book. And from a political angle, the concern is for democratic citizens, the concern is that this is a ready, a manual for how anyone, any would-be tyrant, can then manipulate us and take advantage of us with this information in hand. We are handing it over.
You note that social media puts itself out as a public space, but in fact it acts more like a private venue because of this has to do with sort of tribalism, doesn't it?
That's right.
Because you're connected in Facebook to people who are putatively of like mind.
That's right.
Right? This whole fake news phenomenon that we started seeing, in the last couple of years has to do with people of like mind deciding that information that they're sharing with each other is in fact accurate, even if it isn't.
That's right.
So there's this notion that if I put it out there, I will have this affirmation from other people who say, attaboy, attagirl, way to go.
And then your own prejudices or views are not contested, as is supposed to happen in the public sphere. I mean, it looks to be, at least at this point in history, maybe the jury's still out, but it looks to be that social media is pretty abysmal as a public square. We were told in the early heady days of the internet, this was going to be super. This was going to be, the lifeblood of democracy. And yet what we see is increasing fragmentation of the public and people not speaking to each other and across the divide and then becoming ever hardened in their own views. So this is very troubling indeed. And that's bad news for democracy, clearly.
Well, but don't we see an awful lot of people who disagree with each other whacking away at each other on social media? I mean, all sorts of people, you know, are responding on Twitter and on Facebook, on Instagram, to things that they see with which they vehemently disagree. And matter of fact, the level of discourse, the civility, has attenuated to a startling degree. People often note that they're saying things online that they'd never in a million years say face to face.
There is a different value to face to face public discussion and debate. And I think that that is something that is lost on social media. I'm always amazed by the nasty emails I get from people. I won't say, you know, in various parts of my life. And then when I meet them face to face, they're completely different. And I think there is something more productive in discussing with people face to face, because then you have to contest them on the reasons. You know, there's the emotional factor. You have to see how they're sticking to their views. There's something about this digital communication where people become hardened in their views and they lash out. And that lashing out is not productive, really.
Furman de Brabander, he's an associate professor of philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art here in Baltimore. He's working on a book about online privacy and the paradox that we've been talking about. Coming up after a break, we'll be joined by Melanie Teplinsky. She's a privacy expert who specializes in cyber law and policy issues, as well as Professor Avi Rubin from the Johns Hopkins Information Security Institute. They're going to join me to talk about online privacy in the Trump era. The rules are changing, and we'll talk about what those changes mean, and we will do our best to get your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. Furman de Brabander, many thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after a break. Stick around.
Listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.